wonder if we've covered all the questions.
Or if some of you have some. I had, as I told you, I had a list of particular evidences I had thought of giving today, but I found it was enough for two hours, so I left them all out and spoke on fulfilled prophecy instead, which I think is one of the greatest evidences of all. But I only got over half of what I was hoping to cover on that subject. So if any of you touch in your question on any of these particular things, why, we will mention them. Otherwise, you may have something you're more interested in.
You will
mention
them.
Is Islam responsible for the destruction of much of the images and all throughout the entire Mediterranean world, back in Greece as well as in Egypt and elsewhere?
I'm not sure how much they intentionally did. It is true that the Mohammedans take the second commandment in a more literal way than we Christians do, where it says, thou shalt not make any image of anything in the heaven above or the earth beneath. We understand that to mean, you shall not make it for the purpose of worshiping. But they take it, you must not make it for any purpose. So they, except in Persia, where they don't seem to take it that way, they don't make images, idols, or images or pictures. The Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem is all just geometric figures, very beautiful, but no pictures. But I haven't heard of much just destroying for the sake of destroying. Of course, there in Cairo, they tore them down in order to use the material. But I couldn't say whether. I know that in Greece, one of the greatest damages in Greece was when the Acropolis was blown up. But I think that was done in an attempt to protect it in the war rather than in an intentional destruction. That's my impression. But I really couldn't say with any certainty of that.
Doctor?
Yes?
Isaiah 19:17, that's what I was reading there about Egypt and Israel. Now that we got the Middle East all stirred up, what do you think about that?
Yeah. There are a good many predictions about Egypt, some of which have been literally fulfilled, some of which are probably future. And certainly the last part of Isaiah 19, I was just thinking yesterday, it may be that that is just now coming to the point of being fulfilled, but I wouldn't speak dogmatic enough, because I don't think in most cases the Lord enables us to tell ahead of time exactly what's going to happen. But as things happen, we often see a marvelous evidence of how it fits with the Scripture. But certainly what's happened just lately does seem to fit with this to some extent.
Well, the papers say today that Moscow has given an ultimatum to the Jews to give up all the territory they take.
Well, you have to feel sorry for the leaders of Russia. You can't help them. Here they had a wonderful plan all made. They weren't going to have to fight at all. They just gave all sorts of munitions and airplanes and tanks to the Egyptians and the Syrians. And then they were going to come in and destroy Israel and build up a big empire there and be so grateful to Russia they let Russia control them. And they have twice the equipment that the Jews have. And they say that Nasser was speaking quite confessively a few months ago before the Russian ambassadors came and talked with him, and lately he started this big attack, and now the way they've been driven back, the poor Russians are in a quandary. And Brezhnev and Poseidon have got to, in some way, justify their leadership, or they'll probably be displaced like Khrushchev. So naturally, they're going to speak pretty strong for a while, but whether our government will just bow under and do what they say, or whether they will stand up for what's right is hard to predict. I don't find any biblical statement that enables me to know what our government is.
Do you think the Jews are going to be prepared to keep the territory
of God? I certainly think they should, yeah. Definitely. But I don't think the Bible gives us a definite statement what's going to happen in this regard. I'm afraid from prophecy the Jews have got a lot of misery ahead for them. And I particularly feel that's true because most of what you read shows that in general the people of Israel, they're showing wonderful initiative and energy, but it is largely in forgetfulness of God. And the book, some of you may have read that book, The Source, that came out lately, a novel based on a man's 3 years observations in Israel. And constantly through it, he stresses the lack of interest in religion of so many of the Israelites. They are greatly interested in the history of their ancient people. But the whole tenor of the book is existential, right through. And it gives you the impression that the religion is all just a lot of superstition. And I'm afraid there's just a lot of that in Israel today. Yes?
A little problem reconciling two statements in the Bible. One says that Israel is going to go back to land of unbelief, which seems to be the case today.
Yeah.
And in Deuteronomy 30, it says that God will bring them back from the land of
unbelief. In Deuteronomy, it says that if they turn to Him and repent, He will bring them back. You mean that statement? Yes, well, there have been a number of going back. There was a going back after the Babylonian captivity, which was doubtless a group of godly Jews studying the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah and longing to return and reestablish things in line with God's purposes. That would be a fulfillment of Deuteronomy. But then also we read they're going to go back in unbelief, but there, after going through great miseries, the nation as a whole is going to be converted as a nation born in the day. So we have these different predictions pointing to different times. It's sort of like in Genesis 1 and 2, where some say Genesis 1 and 2 contradict, because Genesis 1 starts in with a watery chaos and Genesis 2 with a dry, desolate land where there's no rain. And the fact of the matter, of course, is they start at different points in the creative process. And at one point, the earth was in a liquid, chaotic form before God started to form this world out of what was there, and the other is after the world had been here for a time, but before man was here. Very often, things appear to contradict, but you look at the situation, and you see how they point to different situations.
Did you mention
I remember toward the beginning of the Second World War when Russia and Germany made their non-aggression pact. And so many people said, that's what the Bible predicts. Germany and Russia are going to get together. And look, you can see prophecy being fulfilled. Well, that was very premature. The Hitler turned on Stalin, and it showed that that was not a prediction of that situation at all. But I think that we can very often grab a verse out of the Bible and say, that fits today, just look. And ignorant people may superficially be led to faith by a superficial argument like that. But then if things develop in such a way it proves that wasn't a reference to this time, we do more harm than good. We should read carefully and be careful not to read into what isn't there. God did not desire simply to satisfy our curiosity, but He did desire that we be ready and serving Him when He comes back. Yes? Yes? In 1929, I was in Jerusalem, and I was talking with a Jew in Jerusalem and told him how I believe that the Pentateuch is true and was written at the time of the events it described. And, oh, he says, in Tel Aviv, the teaching is a J-E-D-N-T teaching in the high school in Tel Aviv. He says, you're a truer Jew than we are. I think he was skeptical of it, because that's what he was taught in the schools with the higher criticism, but he was rather pleased to find somebody who hadn't accepted it. And of course, the higher criticism, I think, has destroyed faith more than anything else in our day. And actually, it simply is a retention into this century of a method of approach that's given up in other literary and historical studies, but it's done tremendous havoc in our century, and is today. And I've seen books written by Jews, by Roman Catholics, and by so-called Protestants, presenting it as established fact. And there's just no evidence for it at any point. I wish we had about 15 hours to look at the assumed evidence and just see how weak every one of them is when you look at the real fact. Any other? Yes, sir? Yeah. Who is it by?
By the man who led the negotiation for those men.
What? Burroughs. Nor Burroughs, was it?
Yes. The point you made about the Bible, he said, first of all, that there was no evidence in all of the Dead Sea Scrolls to disprove the multiple authorship of Isaiah. And secondly, he made the intimation that there were certain manuscript divisions in the Isaiah Scrolls that gave ground for the continuation of the study of the multiple authorship.
I'm surprised at that last one. I don't know quite who could say that. Now, if that was Miller Burroughs, I received a letter a few years ago from someone who said, can you explain this to me? Is it true that among the Dead Sea Scrolls they have found a scroll of the second Isaiah? And does not that prove that Isaiah was written by different writers at different periods, and there's a second Isaiah? Well, the Isaiah scroll, the first of these scrolls found, is the only complete Old Testament book that has been found. So we call that the first Isaiah scroll. Now, at the same time that was found, among those five or six first manuscripts that were found, there was a second Isaiah scroll. And so they tell how the first Isaiah scroll has been published, and how they were preparing to publish the second Isaiah scroll, and so somebody took that as being a scroll of the second Isaiah. And so very definitely, the second Isaiah scroll is not a scroll of the second Isaiah. It is a scroll which must have originally contained the whole Bible, but which now contains sections all through and their pages missing, or parts missing here and there. And so it's not such an evidence. Now as to whether in the ancient copying, in the scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, there might be division. It is altogether possible that there might be a break between Isaiah 39 and Isaiah 40. But anybody who reads can see there is an important break between Isaiah 39 and 40. That doesn't prove it was written by one man or by different men. There's a very important break in thought. But there's just as important a break in thought between 35 and 36. See, 36 to 39 are four historical chapters telling about Isaiah's relationship to Hezekiah. They're very important in the book. Historically, they overlap material also given in Kings and Chronicles, but they tell much more about Isaiah's relationship than those other passages do. These four historical chapters. Now, a chapter of history and a chapter of prophecy are different in their type of material. And so between 35, anybody at all reading 35 and 36 will see at once that he is in a different sort of material. And he will again between 39 and 40. So that 36 to 39 is a historical section right there in the middle. Well, now, before 36 and after 39, the material is much more similar to each other than they are to the section from 36 to 39. But there is a great difference between those, because it would seem that from 1 to 35, God is speaking through Isaiah to the people of Judah, saying, repent, turn back to God, or God will send you into exile for your sins. And in the course of it, he looks forward to the coming of Messiah. He looks forward to his great promises for the future. But the main tenor is a rebuke for their present unbelief and sin. Then after 39, it's as if that is from 39 to 56, middle of 56. It is as if God said to Isaiah, now among the people there are great men, very godly, earnest people. And these people are part of the nation, and they're implicated in the sin. And they realize that what you say about the terrible exile coming is true. And they tend to give way to this death. Now I want you to comfort these people. And so from 36 to 39, when the northern king has already gone into exile, and survivors have escaped and told them about what they're in and everything, the people, the godly, know that faith coming to us too eventually. It was a century later before it did. But they know it's coming. And Isaiah is comforting them, saying, yes, there is this terrible thing ahead on account of the sin of the nation, but God's not through with Israel. God has a great purpose for Israel beyond the exile. He's going to bring them back. He is going to redeem the nation. And out of the nation, he's going to bring the one through whom he's going to redeem all those in the world who have put their trust in him. And so from chapters 40 to 56, you have this wonderful section of comfort and consolation. And then there's a strange thing right in the middle of 56. You have the second most important break in the book. Because the last half of chapter 56 and on through 66, he again is more like the first. He's looking at sin and at God's deliverance, and then at sin and at God's deliverance. But from 40 to 56, there is none of the rebuke that's found in most of the chapters before and after. He does not rebuke for sin and threaten punishment. He tries to comfort them, but says this situation which is coming is the result of your sin, and you need to turn to the Lord for help. So there's a different tone in the middle of it. And the theory of multiple authorship began with the idea that chapters 40 to 66 were written by someone writing in the very spirit of Isaiah, immersed in his phraseology and his method of thought, but writing 150 years later. And that this got put on the same scroll. And then people got confused and thought it was by Isaiah. And then there was a big argument about that, about whether this had Babylon as a background, and it was that, or whether it was part of Isaiah. And then after they argued a while, they found that all those who said this is afterwards were quoting from Isaiah 40 to 55. And those who said, no, this is like the first Isaiah, were quoting from 56 to 66. Because the fact is that in 40 to 55, he puts himself in imagination in Babylon, to which they go in exile and comfort them. And so the background is Babylon, but from 56 on, the background is Palestine again. And so the critics have practically all given up the idea of two Isaiahs now. Now they say there's three. The second one is 40 to 56, and then from 56 to 66 is the third one, which is back in Palestine, but 100 years later. And of course, if you can't believe in predictive prophecy, you have to make some sort of a hypothesis like that. But then the difficulty comes that when you make such a hypothesis, then you find that the evidences that you will give to prove 40 following to be late also apply to many chapters between 1 and 39. We had in this trial out in Seattle, the professor from Harvard said, they were questioning him on this, and he said, well, he says, of course, the author of the first Isaiah, we know when he lived, we know what he believed, we know what he taught, and so on. So I handed the lawyer a little slip. I said, ask him if we can tell what Isaiah taught from Isaiah 13. So he asked him that, and you should have seen the fellow's face when he saw that. He said, well, he says, unlike most scholars, I think there are a few verses in Isaiah 13 that did come from Isaiah. You see that? Your idea of Isaiah 1, 2, and 3 just doesn't work out because the evidence that you give for 2 and 3 divide Isaiah 1 up into all kinds of patchwork. So that actually what you've got is either a wonderful unity with great complexity within it and many strands as God reveals various aspects of truth. Or else if you're going to divide it up, you have to divide it up into 100 different divisions instead of 2 or 3. Yes?
Yes?
Of the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yes.
Well, the first reaction was to deny them. And Dr. Albright and a few others affirmed that they were authentic and true, but the bulk of liberal scholars said they are late, they are not early. Then the linen cloth in which they were found was examined atomically and pretty well proven to be from about the time of Christ. And the evidences have come pretty strongly to show that they do come from the time of Christ a little after or a little before. So now most scholars, not all, there are one or two left who think they're late medieval things. One Jewish scholar said they're not worth the paper they're written on. But most people think that's nonsense to talk about. Most think they're original. So now it is admitted by most they are early and they show our text has been marvelously preserved. Our manuscripts were most of them several centuries later until we found these. Still, they're marvelously preserved, but the anti-Christian scholars are going on to say that in these we find the teacher of righteousness who they say is the man from whom ideas were taken and Jesus was imagined on the basis of these ideas. And so they try to use them as an attack on Christianity, and Wilson's book presenting that has been translated into a dozen languages, but there's no factual foundation for that. And this book of Millar Burroughs definitely denies that whole business. He says the connection between the Dead Sea Scrolls, that is the non-biblical scrolls, and Christianity is far less than the connection between the rabbinic writings and Christianity. Actually, they do not show anything about the foundation of Christianity, and it's purely imagination, but there are a few who are carried away by their imagination. But now Burroughs is a liberal scholar, but he is a very solid, careful scholar, and he definitely denies that sort of thing. He says that you cannot see any origin of Christianity as being based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that, I thought, was one of the excellent things about his two books is how clearly he brought that up. Yes, Mr. Davenport?
I'd like to ask you this.
Yes.
You identified two cities in the
I doubt if anybody can. There is a in view of the fact that Revelation 20 describes after the millennium, the nations at the edge of the world making an attack, and Gog and use the word Gog and Magog there, and also in view of the fact that Ezekiel 36 seems to describe the millennium, I am trying to think that 37 and 38 describe an uprising after the millennium. But that is not what most prophetic scholars believe. Most think it's something before the millennium, based on the idea that Ezekiel 40 and following deals with the millennium. I don't think anybody can tell yet what they are. I think when the time comes, we will see how exactly they fit and see it. Truth that God will speak to the Bible. Yes? Yes? What about 28? Oh, well, in Ezekiel and in Isaiah, we have this picture of Tyre in Ezekiel, and we have the picture in Isaiah of Lucifer in Isaiah 14. And both of these, I believe, are pictures of Satan. I don't think that this is dealing with Tyre. I don't think there was anybody in Tyre that this fit. But after talking about Tyre, I think he turns his attention to Satan. And I think the same is true in Isaiah, where he speaks about Babylon, and then he turns his attention to Satan. I think both of those are predictions of Satan. Mr. Bates?
Coming back to what I said, the U.S. and probably your doctor,
well, all I've seen is the first five, which goes from 1 to 18, and he's done some very careful work in it, and I think he's got some very excellent material in it. One thing I don't understand in it is that he takes the account in Isaiah 11 of the wolf and the lamb lying together and so on, in which you have such a clear picture of the removal of the curse from this world, and instead of making it a picture of the church like most amillennialists do, he makes it a picture of a future age which is coming upon this earth, and then he says, however, this is not a millennium because it doesn't have an end. Well, it seems to me that the evidence, the sound evidence he gives fits with a millennial picture very well. But I think that statement is rather unwarranted, that particular statement. But I think he's done some very good, careful work in it. But just some of his conclusions, I think, are just a little bit unfounded.
When this person gets hurt in Isaiah 19, 17, the rest of the chapter says, not dead, not dead, not dead.
No. In any phrase, in any biblical phrase, or any biblical word, we need to find out how it's used in the Bible. And the phrase in that day is a phrase which I've seen books which have said that in that day means in the end of this age, that it is a technical term for the end of the age. Now, I don't think that's true. From examining many cases of the use of that phrase, Bayom Ha'hu, in that day, as it's translated, it seems to me that it is a phrase which says, in the day I'm now going to tell you about. It doesn't say, in the day I've just told you about, but in the day I'm now going to tell you about. And the day I'm now going to tell you about may be the same day I've just been talking about, or it may be an entirely different day from that. I found a number of instances in Isaiah where I thought the proof was quite clear, but that's what that particular phrase means. So I don't think that if this particular verse describes the condition today, that the succeeding ones necessarily are today's today. In fact, that particular verse is so general. It just says today, but it might be filled again 10 years from now or 100 years from now. While the others, I don't think are necessarily the same time that they may be. Yes, I think I'm afraid our time is nearly to where we must stop, but we can have one more, I guess. Yeah. The Passover plot is one of the wildest pieces of imagination I've ever seen anywhere. It is not original, though. It was the Strauss, the great German skeptic of a century ago, who read The Life of Christ. He wrote a book, The Life of Christ, which had tremendous influence. George Eliot translated into English. It tremendously influenced her. And Strauss, seeing how the life of Christ fit with so many Old Testament prophecies, and how very many of them were fulfilled in his death and resurrection, Strauss said that it must be that Jesus, after reading the Old Testament, thought he'd like to fool people and make them think that he was the one predicted, and therefore he maneuvered in such a way as to get himself crucified. Well, that's pretty hard to imagine. And most people have not followed Strauss in that, even though good many have in other parts of his skepticism. Well, now this book takes exactly the same idea and works out details to pretend that he worked it so he would be crucified, thinking that he could be taken down while he was yet living and be able to make people think he was raised from the dead, and that he made a mistake and he wasn't able to live through it and so died after all. The craziest imagination I've about ever seen. But the sad thing is that people can imagine wild things and then some poor people are misled by it. It's very unfortunate, because it is such a ridiculous thing that if you just read it a little critically, I don't see why anybody should be misled by it. Well, I fear our time is about up.